Welcome to number four.
Let's get an idea of what the splendor of this palace must have looked like, with walls 200 feet thick, Nebuchadnezzar on his throne, the guards around in Babylonian uniforms, swords and spears, and the king looking down at this captive, this exile from Judah, and asked this question. And now he must rely on that night vision and revelation that he received just a few brief hours before, or his head will be taken off. Daniel answered before the king and said, you know, I like this verse because it shows Daniel was human, because he gets a little dig in at the magicians and the conjurers right here. As for the mystery about which the king inquired, neither wise men, they're probably standing around, there may be a few with him in that room. As for the wise men and the conjurers, you point to this group over here, and the magicians and the diviners, why, these fellows couldn't declare it to you. So he gets a little dig in at his competition, at the ones he had just asked to be spared in the previous verse. However, Daniel says, verse 28, a transition here, there is a God in heaven. And this contradicts what we read back in verse 11 that the conjurers were saying, doesn't it? Remember back in verse 11? No one could declare it to the king except what? God, small g, plural. Now, there may be some God somewhere that could declare this dream to you. But now Daniel comes up, puts a little dig into his competition, and now says in verse 28, there is a God in heaven, the God of the heavens, who reveals mystery. And he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days, in the end times. And most of the places in the Old Testament where you see that term, latter days, refers to that future time period, the end time, tribulation, second return, setting up of the kingdom, millennial truth, latter days. So there's something in this dream, Nebuchadnezzar, that's going to tell you and us what's going to happen in the latter days, in that time when Messiah comes back to set up his kingdom. This was your dream, and visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, now he tells Nebuchadnezzar exactly what was happening just the night before. While on your bed, the king, like everyone else, has to go to bed at night, right? And the king is in his bed, and before he can go to sleep, he begins to think. Your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future. Literally, in your future, King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, probably everyone in the room here, I know I do, when I lie in bed at night, what does your mind go to? Well, the events of the day, and what's the next day going to bring, and problems in home, and problems at work, and you think about those things. Well, imagine being a monarch. His mind turns to all these earth-shaking events, wondering what's going to take place. How is this going to affect me? And that's what Daniel says here to Nebuchadnezzar. Before you went to bed, you're thinking about what's going to happen to you. This big kingdom you've established, is it going to last? Are enemies going to come in? Will there be court intrigue? Will you be assassinated? You're thinking about your future, Nebuchadnezzar. And he, God, who reveals mysteries, has made known to me, has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me. I can't take any credit for myself. Daniel gives his disclaimer here. More than any other living man, even more than these around here, he probably said. These conjurers or magicians. But for the purpose, and this is why, Nebuchadnezzar, this is why God revealed this to me. But for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. And in doing so, he's going to record for us these thoughts that God has used so we know what's going to happen in the future. As we look at the book of Daniel, what Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream, the image that we're going to look at, was like a broad brushstroke of future events for the latter days. And in chapters 7 and 8, and on down toward the end of Daniel, Daniel is going to fill in a few more fine details about the latter days, which will add to the information we get in chapter 2. Then later on, and we'll look this morning if we have time, the book of Revelation is going to fill in a few fine details. So this is a broad brushstroke that we're going to see here. Okay, let's see what the dream is, beginning in verse 31. You, O king, were looking. That word in the Hebrew means intensely. You were staring. You were engrossed. Now, you see, Nebuchadnezzar is seeing himself in his dream. It's a dream, right? So he said, in your dream, you were looking. You saw yourself. And you saw yourself looking, staring, and there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. Nothing ever changes, does it? Kids today say, it was awesome, man. Well, here, 2,500 years ago, John, it was awesome. It was an awesome statue. And it comes from the word which means to fear. And back, remember in verse 1, chapter 2, his spirit was troubled. It's a nightmare. Maybe not a real nightmare, but it brought fear to Nebuchadnezzar when he saw this thing. His spirit was troubled. It was an awesome thing. It's shining, it's all metallic, and his spirit was troubled. And it was like a nightmare. And he said, and its appearance was awesome. And here's what it is. The head of that statue is made of fine gold. Its breast and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and of clay, and you continued looking intently until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. So, that's the dream. Now, in telling this dream, obviously, he fulfilled the first criterion that Nebuchadnezzar had, didn't he? Now, he doesn't say, was this your dream? What does he say? This was the dream. And I think at that time, probably Nebuchadnezzar sat back, kind of flabbergasted, didn't know what to think. And the court magicians and conjurers, look, they'd never seen anything like this before. About this amazing dream. Well, the image we see is made out of four metals. Four metals of decreasing value. Gold, silver, bronze, iron, and then iron and pottery. Baked clay, ceramic. And he sees this giant statue, and he's dumbfounded because it's an awesome thing. And as he's looking, he sees this stone cut without hands. Now, apparently, he looked beyond the statue, and there was a great mountain, because we know over in verse 45a, where he's talking again, he said, you saw a stone cut from the definite article mountain. So there must have been a mountain in this vision also. So he's looking, there's a huge mountain like the Rock of Gibraltar, and boom, all of a sudden this stone is cut without hands. Now, among the many things Nebuchadnezzar was famous for was his building project. He was the world's greatest builder, Babylon the Great. Nebuchadnezzar knew stone, and he knew what building stones were, and he knew what cornerstones were, and he knew what stones that were cut by stonemasons looked like. But suddenly here's something supernatural in character, cut without hands. And could it be that when Nebuchadnezzar saw this great stone rushing toward the statue, being the builder he was, he may have thought, well, this is going to be the cornerstone for a magnificent structure to house this wonderful image that was made not for worship but for viewing. Well, surely it can't be some kind of aggressive military action, because as a military man, Nebuchadnezzar knows that if you're going to kill your enemy, you don't hit his feet, you hit his head. And this giant stone is rushing through the air, and suddenly it aims for the feet rather than the head, and it hits this giant statue on its feet. And this is what's going on. And as it plummets toward the image, it strikes this statue on its feet of iron and pottery, and everything begins to crumble. Have you ever seen on TV when they show these demolition crews that'll take down a 50-story building in the middle of town? It's a fantastic thing, isn't it? There'll be big, high-rise buildings all around, and they'll go into one old building, and the charges will be set so strategically that everyone steps back and they push the handle and everything just goes... Big puff of smoke and it's all gone, and the space is empty and all the other buildings are standing. That's what happened here. This supernatural stone hits the image on the feet, crushes it, and then suddenly everything, the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron and pottery, all just begin to crumble and get blown away, as Psalm 1 says, like chaff on the threshing floor when it's thrown in the air. The wind carries it away, and suddenly there was no indication that there was ever an image there. Fantastic thing. Crushed and ground to powder. And as he continues to look, the supernatural stone begins to grow, and the valleys are filled in, other hills are pushed down, and the supernatural stone, he says, becomes a great mountain, verse 35, and fills the whole earth. What an awesome dream. What an awesome vision. And Nebuchadnezzar has to sit back. He slumped back in his chair and his throne and said, that was it. That was my dream. So that confirms verse 9 there, part C, right down at the end. And I'm sure by now, Nebuchadnezzar pushed forward just a little bit on his throne and began to listen more intently to what this young Judean had to say, because he hit the nail on the head, so to speak. Verse 37. Well, preceded by the last half of verse 36, we shall tell its interpretation before the king. You got the first half, now you're going to get part two, the rest of the story. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. So he identifies Nebuchadnezzar with this head of fine gold. Now, what's going to be different about this is, the other metallic parts are going to be kingdom. The head is going to be a king. You, Nebuchadnezzar, the person, are this head of gold. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. See, there was a fine quality about the Babylonian Empire. The fine quality was its unity. It was a unified kingdom under Nebuchadnezzar. As a man once said when asked, are you a dictator? He said, I'm the only tater. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar was. He was the only tater. So what Nebuchadnezzar said was law. And there was a unity in this kingdom that made it unusual when compared to these other kingdoms that were to come. His kingdom spread from the Persian Gulf all the way over to Egypt. So Babylon is identified with the person of Nebuchadnezzar. Napoleon once said, I am France. So that same kind of relationship. The king and the kingdom, one. All right. Verse 39, and after you there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, and then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. Now, we'll see this later on in chapter 5. We'll see it in chapter 8. But for now, all historians and theologians and scholars agree that the next kingdom to come along was the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. So we have now this image set up to give us a picture of what the latter days will be from Nebuchadnezzar's viewpoint. First, he said, you are the head of gold. The kingdom of Babylon is going to be around from, at this time here, when the dream took place, or when Nebuchadnezzar took the throne, 605 B.C., until we know the Medes and the Persians defeated the Babylonians, captured Babylon, as we'll see in chapter 5, in 539 B.C. So this is going to be the length of time, the span, that the Babylonian kingdom lasts. Then, he said, there's going to be another kingdom. Be inferior to you, and remember, this is demonstrated now, isn't it, by the silver breast and arm. Two arms, that's going to be the Medes and the Persians, the Medes and the Persians. And silver was the big means of the economic system in the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, by the way. So this kingdom of the Medes and the Persians is going to last from about 539, when they defeated the Babylonians, on down to 333, when the Medes and the Persians are defeated by Alexander the Great. Then in 333, and really the Medes and the Persians, their kingdom absorbed the kingdom of Babylon. It just expanded and took it into its system. Then when Alexander the Great in 333 conquered the Medes and the Persians, he actually absorbed the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. In fact, toward his latter years, when Alexander began to really go just a little bit crazy, in one marriage ceremony in 324, he married the daughter of Darius III and the daughter of Artaxerxes III in one ceremony to unite himself with the Persians. Alexander the Great lived in Babylon. He dressed like a Persian, which began to cause mutiny among the other Greek soldiers and his officers. He began to live like a Persian monarch. In fact, he began to see himself in the last years before he died as a monarch or emperor over what he called a Greco-Persian empire. So the Greeks really absorbed the Persian empire in Alexander's mind. Then when the Romans came along, kind of unknown when the Romans actually defeated the Greeks. Some say 167 and 146, there was still a league defeated by Mummius at Corinth, 147. So the Romans then absorbed the Greek Empire, defeated them, and took over much of what was always Greece, you know. And then the Romans came in, and this is this fourth kingdom. And he talks about here, verse 40, and there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron. We've all heard of the iron legions of Rome, haven't we? We've all heard of the brazen helmets and shields of the Greeks, too. Insomuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so that iron that breaks in pieces, so like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these pieces. So this is the kingdom. Rome, preceded by Greece, preceded by Medo-Persia, preceded by the Babylonians. Now let's look at verse 41. And in that you saw the feet, now we get a new piece of information in verse 41. Feet and what? Toes. He didn't talk about the toes in the previous explanation of the dream. This is a new piece of information. And in that you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. That word in the Hebrew doesn't mean divided, it means composite. It will be a composite kingdom made up of a lot of different things, as if you took iron and then tried to combine it with pottery. You know, the two would be separated apart, but they'd somehow be in together. It's going to be a composite kingdom. It'll have the firmness of iron, but it's going to be fragile and brittle like clay, like pottery. It'll be a kind of a mix of both. And as we know, in the latter years, Rome became like this. As Rome began to absorb all these different cultures, all these different countries. If you go to Britain, I know Gretchen Schrader was just there, to Bath. In England, you'll see where the Romans were. All the Roman baths are still in England, still there. And you'll probably see much of the Roman architecture, roads, aqueducts. Their kingdom was so expansive. But by absorbing all these different kingdoms and cultures, it became a very weak operation down toward the end. It became fragile but hard. That's what started to happen. So, like iron and clay, they just aren't going to mix. So all these verses, as far as Nebuchadnezzar is concerned, as far as Daniel is concerned, these are verses detailing future events. But yet, so far, these things to us are in the past. We're talking about old kingdoms, aren't we? You know. But what's going to happen is there's a little change that takes place. We know that the official Roman Empire is gone, but yet its influence is still around today in the geographical structure of Europe. That's just about what the old Roman Empire was. In our culture, in our art, in literature, legal system, everything, Constantine and the Caesars, there is an influence felt today from the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire is not gone completely. You see, what happens here, and we're going to see it shortly. Now, we're going to see now a big leap from what was in the past Roman Empire to a future time. And we're living right now in a gap that the Old Testament prophets didn't see. And Scripture is filled with gaps. Because when the Old Testament prophet looked at things, it's as if he looked through a pair of binoculars. You know, when you look through a pair of binoculars, maybe at mountain peaks out west or something, it's hard to tell how far they are apart, right? You lose that sense of depth perception. You see a bunch of mountain peaks, and yet you know there's a lot going on in here, and you really can't tell. That's what Old Testament prophecy is like, and some New Testament prophecy. Mountain peaks with valleys. I'll give you a couple of examples. Isaiah chapter 61. I'll read verses 1 and 2. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives and freedom to prisoners, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. Keep your finger there and turn to the book of Luke, chapter 4. Now, there are many, many, many examples like this. I had a lot of them written down. We just don't have time to do them. So let's go to Luke chapter 4 and look at verse 16. And he, that is Jesus, came to Nazareth, for he had been brought up, and as was his custom, he entered the synagogue on the Sabbath and stood up to read, and the book of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. And he opened the book and found the place where it was written, and here's what we just read. So he's reading Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are downtrodden, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. And he closed the book and sat down. Now look back at 61, where you kept your finger, and look at the very next verse and the verse after, or the next line in that verse and the line after. And the day of vengeance of our God, he didn't read that, did he? To comfort all who mourn. Jesus recognized the gap. He's there at that time period to do just what he read and stop right there. He couldn't read the next line because that hasn't happened yet. That's at his second return, Revelation 19. And to comfort kingdom, Isaiah 40, comfort ye my people. So that's yet future. So here's that passage, and here's the next section of Isaiah 61. We're living in here. You see, so that gap is where we are today, what we call the church age. You can write a little passage down, Ephesians 3, 1 to 6, just in the margin, because there Paul talks about the church age where we are today. And the fact that the Old Testament prophets, when they looked into the future, really didn't see it. Because we have passages that show Christ on the cross, for example, Psalm 22. Passages that talk about a suffering Messiah. And passages that talk about a reigning Messiah. And the question of the prophets was, we don't understand that. Why does a king have to die? And as Paul says, they never could see the gap in between when he came to die and when he's coming again. That's where we are now. Okay? And that's what Paul's talking about in Romans 11. The fullness of the Gentiles, not the times of the Gentiles. See, what we have in the statue by Nebuchadnezzar in his dream, we have the times of the Gentiles. Jerusalem must be trodden down until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Strictly speaking, in that dream, the times of the Gentiles began in 605. The times of the Gentiles still goes on today. And that's the dream, showing the times of the Gentiles. So we're in this gap, and the statue is going to be a gap as well, because the statue, the image, is going to have a gap, and we'll see where it's going to be in just a moment. We know from Daniel and from Revelation and other scriptures that there will be an end-time empire, which will be a resuscitation, a revitalization of the Roman Empire, which Daniel talks about in this image. And we have some indications about what that's going to be. It'll be an end-time confederacy. So let's look at some interesting verses now. And turn, first of all, to Revelation 13, because we're going to look down past our church age to this next mountain peak of prophecy here yet to come, and I'm going to tie these passages together for you in just a minute. Revelation 13, verses 1 and 2. And I stood on the sand of the seashore, John says, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. So we see a beast coming up out of the sea with 10 horns and 10 crowns. Now I'll go over about 4 chapters to Revelation 17 and look at verses 12 and 13. And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. Now let's go back to our book of Daniel, and although we won't cover this for a few weeks, go to Daniel chapter 7. I will look at just a couple of verses here and pick out words in these verses, beginning in verse 4, and see if this sounds familiar. This is a dream that Daniel has, a vision by night, and he sees this beast coming up out of the sea, like a lion, verse 4, like a bear, verse 5, like a leopard, verse 6, iron teeth, verse 7, and at the end of verse 7, 10 horns. Does that sound familiar? Oh, we just read that in Revelation, didn't we? So you see, there's a connection here between what Daniel's going to see involving 10 kings, what John sees in person, looking out in the time of the second coming, time of the tribulation, really. Now look over in verse 24 in the same chapter 7. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and subdue 3 kings. So we're talking about kings here. We're talking about the number 10 here. We're talking about future events here. And now suddenly we're talking about toes.